to the Richard Nixon Experience.
I'll tell you a little story about the summer of 72, though, which is apropos of how our business has changed. I covered the hearings on Capitol Hill. A great anchor man named Frank Reynolds, who died so young, at 59, of cancer, who was our principal anchor man when he died in 1983, was the anchor in the studio. Now, the first week, the three television networks, and remember there were only three, covered the hearings from gavel to gavel. Sam Ervin, the senator from North Carolina, presiding. Howard Baker, the Republican senator from Tennessee, his Republican counterpart. Country was riveted. And they were calling all these top White House officials to testify. But the network said, we're losing all this money. So they decided that every third day, one of us would do the gavel to gavel, the other two would run the soap operas. So every third day, it was Frank and Sam. So I say, every third day, if you wanted to watch those hearings, and millions and millions and millions did, you had to watch me. You didn't have a choice. It wasn't the question, I like this other person better, you know, or, hey, this guy's not too bright. You had to watch me. I point this out only because today, for instance, the new anchors of the evening news broadcasts, they're very capable, they're very good, no question about it. Try to compare them with Walter Cronkite or the great Huntley Brinkley or the three that they've taken their places, the late Peter Jennings or Tom Brokaw or Dan Rather. It's not a question of comparison. They don't have the chance to assemble the same size audiences because of fragmentation. They're never going to be in a position where you had to watch this guy or this gal like they once had to watch just me. The fragmentation has simply not only cut into the ability to assemble large audiences, but cut in, of course, to the profit margins of these organizations. Cable has mainly done that. Cable's a good thing, but it's changed the business.
Let me just say that as I said in my letter to the president yesterday, that I am convinced that when the truth is known on all of this, that I will be seen as totally clear of any of the implications or allegations that have been made regarding any wrongdoing or any failure to meet the extremely high standard of conduct and integrity that I've always set for myself, and that the president has very rightly set for all of us in the White House. Beyond that, I intend to cooperate, as I said, fully with all of the appropriate authorities and in the proper forum, and to do so voluntarily, as I've always intended to do. And I believe that nothing really is served by any public comment or adding to the public discourse on all of this, and I don't intend to add anything further to that. And I thank you very much.
The Watergate hearings began in low-key fashion yesterday, but today the senators began getting to the heart of the matter. James W. McCord, Jr., the Watergate conspirator who virtually blew the lid off the case 2 months ago by vowing to tell all he knew, told his story in public for the first time. ABC's Sam Donaldson reports.
Now at last, under oath and in public, James McCord, the one-time security director for the committee to re-elect the president, fleshed out the charges alluded to in his letter to the judge. Much of McCord's story had leaked in one form or another, so when the committee began questioning him on the Watergate conspiracy, it came as no surprise to hear the names of former high administration officials. But the high point was yet to come, and McCord made it in a carefully written statement to the committee.
Political pressure from the White House was conveyed to me in January 1973 by John Caulfield to remain silent, take executive clemency by going off to prison quietly, and I was told that while there I would receive financial aid and later rehabilitation and a job. I was further told in a January meeting in 1973 with Caulfield that the President of the United States was aware of our meeting, that the results of the meeting would be conveyed to the President, and that at a future meeting, there would likely be a personal message from the President himself.
There's still another Watergate investigation in the offing, the one to be conducted by a special prosecutor chosen by Attorney General Designate Elliot Richardson. Today, Richardson named the man he has picked for the job. He is Archibald Cox, who served as U.S. Solicitor General during the Kennedy administration.
Jeff, when we broke off at the end of segment six, there was a special counsel appointed. Because Ehrlichman and Haldeman had resigned, John Dean had been fired. What led to the appointment of that special counsel specifically, and why was Archibald Cox picked?
Well, the month of April 1973 is really key because it goes from John Dean retaining criminal defense counsel to disclosing all kinds of stuff to the career prosecutors, culminating in the Department of Justice coming to the White House and saying to Nixon, you must remove Ehrlichman and Haldeman from your staff because John Dean has accused them of being involved in a conspiracy.
Who came from the Justice to deliver that message to the President?
The Attorney General, Dick Kleindienst, and the head of the criminal division, the longtime career prosecutor, Henry Peterson.
With the tape system still working?
Yes.
So this
Absolutely.
Is on tape.
It's on tape.
All right.
It's on tape.
So they come
it's
and they
Sunday.
Tell him, you've got
it's
to fire these guys.
Yeah, let me drop back just a little bit and run you through. I'm just working on domestic affairs, law and order. And out of nowhere, Henry Peterson, the career head of the criminal division, says he wants to take me to lunch. And I'm not important. Nobody takes me to lunch. My entire 5 years, nobody took me to lunch. I had staff mess.
Did you have mess privileges?
You bet I did.
Right,
so I just went to work, went to eat, got back. If I wanted to show off, I could take people to lunch.
That's what I did, too.
Never. Boy, you better believe.
Yeah, man, it's the very one perk that a low-level lawyer has
you
is
got
to
it.
Take someone
very
to lunch.
Very impressive.
Yes.
So I go to lunch with Henry. Henry says, you know, what's going on? You know, what are you working on, all this? And at the end of lunch, he says, Jeff, I'm going to tell you something, and I don't want you to tell anybody else, but Haldeman and Ehrlichman are going down. I said, you got to be kidding. I work with them. I know them. They're super stand-up people. He said, listen very carefully. Haldeman and Ehrlichman are going down. I realize you're not involved. I don't want you to do anything stupid because we need you at the White House. We have to have someone there that we can trust. And then he goes back, and I didn't believe him, goes back to the Department of Justice, and he tells everybody at the Department of Justice, the only person they can talk to is Jeff Shepard. Now, it's because I worked on policy stuff. See, I had no connection with John Dean or what had been going on. But John had said, when he first went to the prosecutors and his lawyer, I can give you Mitchell, I can give you Magruder, because they knew about the break-in. And the prosecutors say, you know, we don't really need you. We've got Magruder, he's here too, and we, that testimony doesn't do any good. So in his book, he says, he's talking to his lawyer.
John Dean says
John
in his
Dean,
book.
In his book, Blind Ambition, he says, he's talking to his lawyer, Charlie Schaffer, and he says, I don't want to meet with those career prosecutors anymore. And Schaffer said, you have to because they are going to accuse you criminally. You'd better start talking conspiracy or you're going to be left out there all by yourself. And then two paragraphs later, he says, that conspiracy idea is not bad. And you can see it in the notes. You go to the National Archives and you can hold in your hand the notes taken by the career prosecutors at every meeting they had with John Dean. And the notes change and he starts saying, those guys knew what I was doing.
But what I was doing after the original break-in through the March meeting.
Absolutely. Even John Dean, who's not my favorite guy, has never said anybody in the White House staff knew about the break-in. But what happened was the idea of exposing people who knew about the break-in, changing that to, well, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up, And all of you guys, you important guys, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and maybe Nixon, you were in on the cover-up. And it changes everything.
Sure.
And then he takes files from his office that have nothing to do with Watergate, and he gives them to the prosecutors, and he says, here, these guys are evil. These guys were doing things that you should be worried about. And they say, we don't want this stuff. It's got nothing to do with Watergate. It's called the White House Horrors. And there's a list of it. And it's the 17 National Security Council wiretaps done without court order. The plumber's break-in. They were so worried Hunt was going to spill the beans. John Dean spilled the beans in negotiating for personal immunity. There's stuff called the milk producers' price supports. There's some other things.
The ITT scandal?
The ITT scandal wasn't in the White House counsel's records.
Is the enemies list a part of this?
Well, John Dean talked about the enemies list. John Dean said he was going to get, it's on the tape, get the IRS to do tax reviews of people we didn't like.
Which tape is that on?
I can't tell you.
Okay, so John Dean.
It's an April tape.
It's an April 1973 tape.
Just to finish that up, he tries to do that, and our appointees, Johnny Walker at Walters at the IRS and George Shultz, the Secretary of the Treasury, said, the hell we will.
Johnny Walters came to me and said, John Dean, the president's counsel, has just brought me a list of, I think, 50 names of people and wants a full field investigation of them. That's a very unpleasant thing to have happen to you. What should I do? And I said, don't do it. And he said, well, what shall I tell John Dean when he asks me how it's going? I said, tell him that you report to me. If he has a problem, he's got a problem with me. So they never brought it up with me, although on the tapes there's a discussion between the president and John Dean about who do I think I am holding this up. But it was an improper use of the IRS, and I wouldn't do it. When it came to anything of that kind where you're using the power of government, I think, and I held then and I stuck to it, that you've got to do it properly. And I was being asked to do something improper, and I wouldn't do it. And I think things like that had been done before. And so maybe the president thought he was just doing what others have done, but anyway, not with me.
We don't do tax audits for political
purposes.
But
this dump of bad things
yeah.
that have happened at the
yeah.
White House that we've
yes.
covered in previous tapes and we're not. I'm just trying to stay on what happened with Watergate. Dean does this in what? In order to entice a better plea bargain?
Yes, absolutely.
Because he'd had a plea bargain already, but now he's facing something more.
No, he doesn't have a plea bargain.
Ah.
He's working it out, and the career guys will not give him immunity. They say, no. After and their notes say, Dean's not telling us what he was doing. Dean's holding back. He's only telling us what he thinks other people were doing. So in the end, Dean is out in the public saying, I was just looking for the truth. I'm not going to be the scapegoat. I just want the truth. But his lawyer is in there saying, immunity or nothing. Either we get immunity or you're not going to.
This is, what about the president? We can't talk about the P. I says, the P? I says, what are you talking about, the P? He says, it's the national security. It's attorney-client privilege. It's this, that's the other thing. I says, if the two of you in the pod committing the crime together, I says, there's no privilege that protects one co-conspirator from another co-conspirator.
It was clear that what he was saying was that the president knew all about what was going on and had been advised and was reported to and was informed of things.
That was a very persuasive argument, and Seymour is very persuasive. I just felt differently.
We told him, Silber told him unequivocally that there was not going to be immunity for Dean.
I said, no deal, and I told Glanza, I said, Glanza, you haven't got the only show in town.
We are beginning these hearings today in an atmosphere of utmost gravity. the questions that have been raised in the wake of the June 17 break-in strike at the very undergirding of our democracy. If the many allegations made to this date are true, then the burglars who broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee at Watergate were in effect breaking into the home of every citizen of the United States. And if these allegations proved to be true, what they were seeking to steal was not the jewels, money, or other property of American citizens, but something much more valuable, their most precious heritage, the right to vote in a free election. We will inquire into every fact and follow every lead, unrestrained by any fear of where that lead might ultimately take us.
And when does he offer the White House horrors?
I think it's around April 22nd.
As part of the plea negotiation.
He leaves the White House over the weekend and doesn't come back. And that's when I get that call saying, do you know where John Dean is? Because they're looking for him. And then it's slowly dawning on them, particularly when Kleindienst and Peterson come over and say he's accusing these guys of being in on the cover-up, and when that becomes public, you don't want them on your staff. It takes Henry Peterson 19 meetings or phone calls with Nixon over the course of the second half of April 1973 to convince him he has to fire his two closest colleagues. So then out of nowhere, on April 30th, news to all of us, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Kleindienst, and Dean are gone.
Why is Kleindienst included in the firing resignation?
It's funny you should ask. Perhaps because Nixon felt Kleindienst should have done a better job on the investigation. He wouldn't be in this problem if he had. Perhaps because Kleindienst said, I'm too close to John Mitchell and I really shouldn't be here. Perhaps because Haldeman and Ehrlichman said, you know, we wouldn't have to go if he had done his job. It could be Nixon wanted to dilute the impact of firing his two top people, but it was a key to Nixon's demise.
And that's because a new attorney general arrived.
Well, he had to name a new attorney general who had to be confirmed by the Senate, which wasn't in his hands, at a time when the Senate Judiciary Committee was controlled by Ted Kennedy, his mortal enemy. So in that speech on April 30th, Nixon says, and for our new attorney general, I'm naming Elliot Richardson. Elliot Richardson is Mr. Clean. He's been confirmed four separate times as Under Secretary of State, as Secretary of HEW, as Secretary of Defense, and then the fourth time as Attorney General. And I've given him permission to appoint a special supervising prosecutor, that's the term of art, to help him with Watergate. And Nixon knew that Richardson had aspirations within the party and that it would be tough to make the decision on which Republicans got indicted and which Republicans didn't get indicted. So he thought he would put somebody between Henry Peterson, in whom he had great respect and confidence, the head of the criminal division, and Elliot Richardson, put someone in between maybe a politically connected lawyer who could help Richardson make those final calls. So he announced that. And he was thinking of Teapot Dome when they were investigating. They appointed one Republican and one Democrat to go through and find out what was going on. But he got mousetrapped because in the course of the Senate confirmation hearings on Elliot Richardson, who didn't want to be Attorney General, he was out clear. He was Secretary of Defense, had nothing to do with Watergate and didn't want anything to do with Watergate. But Nixon said, I need you. You've got to come over as Mr. Clean and help me clean this thing up. They told Richardson that, yes, we want a special prosecutor, but we want one who has total and unreviewed independence from the Department of Justice. And Richardson ultimately agrees to a set of guidelines that the department will have nothing. This is totally separate.
Who wrote the guidelines? Senator Kennedy?
Senator Kennedy's people wrote the guidelines.
Did they stipulate Archibald Cox?
No, but Archibald Cox, Richardson said, I will tell you my choice before you confirm me. And ultimately he picked Archibald Cox. And there's an article in the Boston papers saying Cox was Kennedy's choice all along. He'd been Elliot Richardson professor when he was at Harvard Law School, but he was part and parcel of the Kennedy political machine.
May I inject?
Archibald Cox was Jack Kennedy's top speechwriter. He traveled on the campaign plane with him. He assembled Kennedy's famous Harvard Brain Trust, and he was rewarded for that intimate relationship with Jack Kennedy by being named Solicitor General in Robert Kennedy's Department of Justice. Robert Kennedy was the youngest attorney general in the nation's history, and Cox was supposed to be the old man in the room to keep things
straight.
He was
an extraordinary professor and a giant of constitutional law. How did he assemble his special prosecutor team after Elliot Richardson agreed to appoint him, and he had, in effect, de facto independence from the attorney general?
Well, not de facto. He had actual independence from the attorney general.
Well, he could have been fired because he was fired.
He was fired on the order of the president of the United States. Elliot had entered into an agreement that he wouldn't fire him. It's all in his guidelines that Senator Kennedy's staff negotiated with Richardson. And they said at the time to people whom I knew that they discovered that Elliot would accept any push, that he'd never push back. So they kept asking for more and more and more. And Elliot was perfectly happy to wash his hands of the Watergate scandal. So he entered into a set of guidelines that turned everything over to the special prosecutor. Cox's first two hires, he's named on May 25th. Elliot's sworn in at the White House. Cox is sworn in that afternoon. Ethel Kennedy comes, Senator Kennedy's staff comes. It's a hallelujah chorus for Democrats because now they have gotten control of the investigatory and prosecutorial powers of the Department of Justice. This is an inversion of our Constitution. The top 17 people came from the Kennedy Department of Justice. These are the people removed from power by Nixon's 1968 election who now are back into power without a vote of the people, and they announce at their first press conference they're going to investigate every allegation made against the Nixon administration in the 6 years that it's been in office.
This is the part of the story few people really know, and no member of the media has ever bothered to explain, that Archibald Cox filled his staff with rabidly anti-Nixon staffers that made no bones about wanting to get Richard Nixon, as a tape we had in an earlier episode exposed. And where the case of John Dean is concerned, the story was that Archibald Cox himself was opposed to giving the president's lawyer a free pass. Senator Howard Baker felt the same way about Dean, and as he saw this gathering storm aimed at Richard Nixon, he set out to try to blunt it.
It was absolutely natural for the ranking Republican, the senior Republican, to go down to the White House and say, look, I'm your friend, and I'm going to try to keep these heathen devils from biting your ankle.
Baker felt like Dean should not get immunity, but the Democrats had stacked the deck, and he had to acquiesce to the power of the Democrats on the committee because he, as the patriot that he was, wanted this committee to be united in the eyes of the public and not partisan.
I especially resented that he really showed no trace of remorse about his lack of fidelity to his former boss.
Baker then said, why should we give immunity to the worst criminal in Watergate? He's the one that ought to be indicted. He's the one that should be imprisoned, John Dean. Senator Baker then said to Gurney, well, you know, we do want the public to respect this committee, and it won't look good that if we seem like we're not all together. So I'm willing to change my vote.
The committee voted unanimously to request Judge Sirico to enter orders allowing the committee to give immunity to John W. Dean III.
The chairman is fond of pointing out from time to time that he is just a country lawyer. He omits to say that he graduated from Harvard Law School with honors.
I'll explain that.
senator from Tennessee will yield, I'd like to say a word in my own defense on that point. I had a friend introduce me to North Carolina audience. He said he understood I was a graduate of the Harvard Law School, but thank God nobody would ever suspect it.
This is Randall Wallace, your host for Bridging the Political Gap. I want to thank you first for tuning in to our podcast and invite you to come to our website, randallwallace.com. There you can get a copy of our book, Always Vote Your Conscience, Don't Take It Personally, and Don't Fight the Same Old Battles Over and Over Again, with a lot of policy suggestions and things that I think everyone could embrace, an argument for why we need to be working together instead of fighting with each other. Also, you can take a look at the first 11 episodes of this podcast, which was a podcast documentary that looked at the World War II generation of bipartisan leadership that built the American century and the lessons we can learn from them to apply to today's situations. Again, thanks for tuning in to our podcast. And if you've enjoyed our show, please leave us a review at wherever you get your podcast. And now, let's get back to the show.
Why you? How did you come to be chosen as chairman of the Watergate Committee?
Mike Mansfield, I think, is one of the finest human beings I've ever known. And he wanted the investigation to be fair, and not only wanted to be fair, but he wanted the appeal to be fair. So the first thing he did was rule out for membership among the Democrats any Democrat that was suspected of being wanting to be president or vice president. That included most of the Democrats in the Senate.
All right.
And so having done that, he told me he wanted to be chairman for three reasons. The first was that I had had more judicial experience than anybody in the Senate. The second was I was the most nonpartisan Democrat he had in the Senate. And the third was that nobody could justly accuse me of ever having harbored vice presidential or presidential ambitions.
What did you expect to discover at the beginning? Did you think it would reach the president?
I didn't imagine, however, the president was involved.
You did not.
I thought we would find that some of his overzealous aides had overstepped the bounds of political decency.
Did it dawn on you slowly or of a moment that the president was involved?
Well, if I became suspicious that the president wasn't toting fair with the, use the North Carolina term, with the country in the matter. Because as soon as the committee was set up, before it had an organizational meeting or had hired a single aide, President Nixon issued a public statement in which he said under the doctrine of executive privilege, he would not permit any of his aides or former aides to testify before the committee. But I have noticed a long time that a person is in being investigated or tried, and they have any information, they have power that would exonerate them. They can't run fast enough to carry it to the fact finder.
After the call went out, we responded from the area of 30th and K down to the front of the Watergate on one of the doors leading from the B1 level, from the garage into the B1 level. Looking at the door had been taped with a sort of a light-colored mastic tape where the door would shut, and from all appearances, the door would be locked. But the lock is held in by the tape where the door will shut, but it will not lock.
So this tape was on the edge of the door.
Yes, sir.
Forcing back the lock that would ordinarily spring and lock the door.
Yes, sir.
And keeping it from being locked.
Yes, sir.
And what did you understand the purpose of that taping to be then?
At that time, it would give anyone that was wanting to go in and out accessibility without having to use a key or to a pick or something to unlock it. We met up again with Officer Barrett down to this area, checking the offices that were open as we came down the hallway. We came into this room here through a glass door. Officer Barrett was the first man through, followed by myself and Officer Schaffler. Officer Barrett responded up into this area here, and I started into this little secretarial cubicle here. Officer Schaffler was somewhere in this area. And at this point, I heard Officer Barrett yell, "Hold it, come out."
At that where was that
Officer
voice coming
Barrett,
from?
Sir?
Yes, where was that voice coming from?
Right in this area, right here, sir.
Right.
Officer Barrett was right in this area. At this time, I responded back out of the cubicle, in through this cubicle, and jumped up on a desk, drawing my weapon. And when I looked over this glass partition, there was five men standing in front of a desk with their hands either raised above their heads or at least shoulder high. One of the men was carrying an AWOL bag, an overnight bag, a semi-large brown bag with his coat draped over it, and it contained various items, cameras, bulbs, clamps for clamping the cameras to the desk, walkie-talkies, things of that sort.
Did you later find out who they were?
Yes, sir.
Could you name the persons who you arrested in that location by the names that you later found out who they were to be?
Frank Sturgis, Bernard L. Barker, James McCord, Eugenio Martinez, and I think it's Virgil Gonzalez.
Cover would be taken off of the telephone, and two of the wires connected with this would be interconnected in series with the wiring within the phone itself. Political pressure from the White House was conveyed to me in January 1973 by John Caulfield to remain silent, take executive clemency by going off to prison quietly, and I was told that while there I would receive financial aid and later rehabilitation and a job. My participation in the Watergate operation on my part, for whatever reasons I may have had at the time, whatever rationale I may have had at the time, was an error, was a mistake, and a very grave mistake, which I regret.
Now we will hear from various players involved, starting with Jeb Magruder, who had already committed perjury and whose story as to who approved the operation is different from from both John Mitchell and Fred LaRue, who were the only two other people in the room when this whole thing was approved or not approved in Florida. We'll also hear from Maurice Stans, who is one of the great Republican fundraisers of all time, who somehow or another was also drawn into the scandal. And that'll be followed by John Mitchell, who was in charge of the committee to reelect the president. And if you listen, you'll also hear the belligerent tone of the Senate Committee Chairman Sam Ervin.
Approval for initial entry into the Democratic National Committee headquarters in Washington, and that at a further date, if the funds were available, we would consider an entry into the presidential contenders headquarters, and also potential at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami.
Did it also include use of electronic surveillance and bugging?
It included electronic surveillance and photography of photographing of documents.
If you were concerned because the action was known to you to be illegal, because you thought it improper or unethical, that you thought the prospects for success were very meager, and you doubted the reliability of Mr. Liddy, what on earth would it have taken to decide against that plan?
Well, the substance of the instruction was that file, which I had for some reason called a strategy file.
Called a strategy file?
A strategy file.
That file, which you called a strategy file.
Which I later referred to, I guess, possibly as a strategy file.
Right.
And the advertising files.
Now, wait a minute. Did Magruder or Reisner mention a file by name, by category, or classification, a strategy file or any other file?
I thought that the word strategy was used, yes.
Did anybody mention to you the word gemstone?
No, sir.
Do you know what gemstone means?
I don't know what it means. I've seen the word in the newspapers lately.
Well, do you know now what was in it?
Well, I've known, I can speculate what was in it.
You suspected the gemstone material was in it?
I suspect that things which have no place in a political campaign were in it, yes, sir.
That record, Mr. Chairman, to the best of my recollection, I destroyed.
You destroyed?
Yes.
And you swam, you stating upon your oath, that there's no connection between the destruction of these records and the break-in of the Watergate or any fail that the press or the public might find out from these records what the truth was about these matters.
Well, let me speak only with respect to myself. I will say to you that there was no connection between my destruction of the summary sheets given to me by Mr. Sloan and the Watergate affair.
Well, it was quite a queer coincidence, wasn't it?
It's rather a suspicious coincidence
that the records which showed these matters were destroyed 6 days after the break-in at the Watergate.
Mr. Chairman, the adjectives are yours.
So?
The adjectives that you're using, queer, coincidence, and suspicious.
Well, don't you think it's rather suspicious?
No, I don't, Senator.
You think it's perfectly normal of the kind of things you would expect people who had records concerning outlays of campaign funds to destroy the records after five men are caught in an act of burglary with money that came from the committee in their pockets?
The fact that they came to me after the Watergate was pure and innocent coincidence.
My reaction was representative of most of my colleagues, that here was a valiant soldier standing up for his general.
The Irvin Committee wanted to know if Mitchell had indeed authorized the Watergate break-in, as Jeb Magruder said he did. Mitchell denied it. The senators tried to get some idea of what the president had known about Watergate. Mitchell didn't make it easy for them.
When do you think the president found out about Watergate and the cover-up?
I haven't any idea, Senator. I haven't any idea at all.
Why hadn't Mitchell taken it upon himself to tell the president that his re-election committee was behind the break-in? Not only had he kept quiet about that, he hadn't told the president about earlier proposals for illegal activities. Mitchell himself called those plans the White House horrors. He had not told the president about any of it, Mitchell said, in order to protect him.
Now, you state that you kept silent concerning the things you knew because you considered the re-election of President Nixon of such extreme importance.
That is correct, sir.
I wonder if your statement ought not to be changed a little bit. You say that you didn't want President Nixon to find out about the White House horrors. Isn't it the fact that you didn't want the American people to find out about it?
Well, I think that's one and the same because, as I testified before, that if the president had found out about it, obviously he would have pursued his responsibilities in that area very vigorously.
And you were afraid to tell the president, rather you, I won't say afraid, but you preferred not to tell the president and didn't tell the president because you didn't want the president to do what you call lowering the boom.
That's exactly correct.
And if he had lowered the boom, why, the thing would have been exposed.
I don't think there's any doubt about it.
And the American people would have learned about it.
They would have learned about it.
And it might have affected the votes of the American people.
It's quite conceivable.
Yes.
I don't expect to the extent that some of us might believe. I think that's a matter for debate, but it certainly could very well have affected the election.
You know, I have a high opinion of American people in that. I think that the president had lowered the boom. If you'd told the president lowered the boom and had come out performing his constitutional duty to see that the laws be faithfully executed, I think he would have made his election more sure than ever.
Some of the senators were incredulous that Mitchell could even have listened to Gordon Liddy's astonishing proposal for a sordid lawbreaking in the campaign. After all, he was Attorney General of the United States.
There is one man that has got to stand above all else in this nation in the sense of enforcing our laws. It's the Attorney General of the United States. I know that Mr. Mitchell figures why he toughed it out on behalf of his boss, but I don't think there's anything to boast about there. I think he should have toughed it out on behalf of the people of the United States.
I must confess, Mr. Mitchell, that as I have sat here and listened to your testimony, the only difficulty I find with it is that it is sometimes difficult to realize that we have sitting before the committee not some administrative assistant to some deputy campaign director, but we have the campaign director sitting before this committee. And indeed, we don't have some deputy assistant attorney general sitting before the committee. We have the Attorney General of the United States sitting before the committee.
Senator Weicker kept pressing Mitchell. Why hadn't he been appalled by the Liddy schemes? Why hadn't he reacted in a way that would put an end to this kind of thing that eventually led to the plan for a burglary at the Watergate?
Now, on the 27th of January, 1972, Gordon Liddy presented a plan in your office, in the office of the Attorney General of the United States. And that plan, complete with visual aids, included elaborate charts of electronic surveillance and breaking and entering and prostitution and kidnapping and mugging. Now, you've indicated that in hindsight, you probably should have thrown him out of the office.
Out of the window, I think.
Maybe even out of the window, in hindsight. The life of every American, his, or to a great degree, his liberty, protection of all of his rights, sits in the hand of the Attorney General of the United States. And do you mean to tell me that you sat there through that meeting, and in fact actually had the same man come back into your office for a second meeting, without in any way alerting appropriate authorities, in this particular case, the President of the United States?
That is exactly what happened, Senator. And as I say, in hindsight, it was a grievous error.
Senator Baker tried to understand Mitchell's concept of the presidency.
Is the presidency so shrouded in mystique? Is there such an aura of magnificence about the presidency? Is there such an awesome responsibility for a multitude of problems and undertakings of this nation that the presidency, in some instances, must be spared the detail, must be spared the difficulty of situations which, in more ordinary circumstances, might be considered by some, at least, to be frank, open declarations of criminal offense? Is the presidency to be protected in that way? Is the splendor of the isolation so great that the president must be protected? And if so, in what cases?
It is my opinion and my concern with respect to this particular presidency that he should not have been involved in connection with these matters that bore directly upon his election. And he should have been protected from the knowledge of them.
In the interest of
his reelection.
Why isn't that a presidential grade decision? Why, of all decisions that might be made by the man, the candidate for President of the United States, why shouldn't he be permitted to make that decision? What is it that arrogates that authority to someone else other than the president to take a material step that will significantly affect not only his election prospects and chances, but his presidency if
Because of the consequences that would obviously flow from it.
Why shouldn't he make that decision?
If he were to make the decision, there would be no alternatives. He would have a choice of being involved in what you all referred to as a cover-up, or he would be involved in the disclosures which would affect his reelection.
All of those things were inferior in importance to the ultimate reelection of the president.
I have no doubt about it at that time, and I have no doubt about it now.
Isn't it unfair that he's now undergoing the hostility and the suspicion of a nation in this respect, with the allegations of cover-up, with the lingering suspicion about what he knew?
Well,
isn't that greatly, isn't that far more unfair.
That's a statement that I'm not prepared to accept, Senator. I do not believe the nation feels that way, and I don't believe that anybody has come to the point where they have one shred of evidence that he was knowledgeable of the break-in or the cover-up.
I think you and I are talking about two different things. I'm talking about suspicion.
Obviously, because we generally get along fine.
Well, we still do get along fine, and I'm delighted that I have this opportunity to probe into a great mentality of a great man.
Well, Senator Baker found himself in a very unique role. He never made any bones about the fact that he wished that his friends, Richard Nixon and John Mitchell and some of the others, you know, John Mitchell picked up the phone one day and asked Howard Baker if he'd like to be on the Supreme Court of the United States. I mean, you don't proceed as if those things never happened. What you do is acknowledge them and then do what you got to do.
After 2.5 days of testimony, the committee excused John Mitchell, but not before the normally controlled Sam Dash made an indignant observation.
Now, Mr. Mitchell, do you draw this distinction, and you've made it from time to time that it was your purpose not to volunteer anything, a distinction between not volunteering and lying?
Well, it depends entirely on the subject matter.
Now, when you ask the direct question and you don't volunteer the direct answer, you might say you're not volunteering, but actually you're lying on those.
Well, I think we'd have to find out what the specifics are of what particular occasion and what case.
Well, I'll go back to the July 5 question of the FBI as to whether or not you had any information on the DNC break-in, and your answer, only what you read in the newspapers.
I found that John Mitchell tried to evade us and to avoid answering questions. He got the award for stonewalling.
Simultaneously, as the Irving Committee, staffed by Ted Kennedy alumni staffers, were on TV doing all they could to pin something on the president, Archibald Cox was putting his team together, and they all had one thing in common as well. They were all from the office or from alumni of the Kennedy and Johnson Justice Department, or they were young, rabid partisans, and they all had one target, Richard Nixon.
Can you very quickly summarize for our audience the names and natures of the key players on the Cox team?
Yes. Archibald Cox's first two hires are two fellow professors from Harvard Law School, James Vorenberg. Cox taught labor law. James Vorenberg, who teaches criminal law, and Phil Hayman, who had been with Cox in the Solicitor General office under Robert Kennedy. And they meet on that weekend following the May 25th naming with Ted Kennedy's top staff member, James Pflug. And they spend all of Sunday afternoon talking about what they should do with this investigation. I have James Vorenberg's 7 pages of handwritten notes about those discussions.
And who did they hire beneath them? Because as we all know from the very recently concluded Mueller investigation, it's not the top person who matters so much.
Right.
It's number 2, 3 through 100.
Well, the top 17 people all work together in the Kennedy-Johnson Department of Justice.
That's astonishing.
It is. No, it's just astonishing. I have a chart that shows where everybody was. The top guy in the Watergate task force. Now, there are 5 task forces. Watergate, the plumbers, campaign finance, dirty tricks, and the ITT scandal, which the White House wasn't involved in.
Stop, Jeff Shepard. I have to ask. We'll come back to the task forces. Richard Nixon is one of the great political minds of American political history. He has been on 5 national tickets. The only other person who has done that is FDR. I knew him personally. You knew him personally. I never discussed Watergate with him. How in the world did he not foresee this most obvious of unfolding series of events that when he removed Kleindienst and put in Elliot Richardson and Richardson agreed to this set of guidelines drafted by Ted Kennedy, that there would be a D-Day style Normandy landing of the political enemies whom he had accumulated over his long and storied career?
He lost control. Nixon did not believe he had done anything wrong. He didn't happen to believe Haldeman Ehrlichman done anything wrong, but he didn't believe he'd done anything wrong. And so bringing in Mr. Clean, Elliot Richardson, seemed like a good idea at the time. Elliot wanted someday to run for president. That's why he didn't want to become attorney general. And so he was happy to wash his hands, turn all this over. He bragged to the Senate Judiciary Committee during his confirmation hearings that he did not tell the White House about those guidelines.
But Jeff, I want to pause on this for the benefit of the audience. In 1980, after I'd gone off to law school, the president kindly recalled me to New York for a dinner in which he anticipated correctly the vote of every state in the 1980 election against Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter. He is known far and wide for the ability to anticipate political events. How could he not anticipate that Elliot Richardson would appoint, if not Archibald Cox, someone like him, and that everyone on Cox's staff would be out to get him? How could he not have known that?
He pictured a teapot dome type of investigation, which was done in a straight manner. He had lost his right and left arm, Haldeman and Ehrlichman. He had chosen Al Haig to come back and be his chief of staff. Well, Al Haig was a political general and thought he knew the ways of Washington. He was no match for Senator Kennedy's group or the special prosecutor's group. They ceased to clear, under Elliot Richardson, anything with the White House. And having lost total control, Nixon had no place to hide.
The deal with Dash was the dean was to come right out of my office and appear on public session, on television, in the Senate.
Subcommittee will come to order.
Dean's appearance was carefully staged. Horn-rimmed glasses instead of his usual contact lenses, and a new short haircut.
Republicans were absolutely helpless to do anything with Dean's testimony.
Accordingly, keeping the Republicans away from Dean before he testified paid off. Baker had to digest 245 pages of complex testimony as Dean delivered it.
I said, this is like trying to shovel smoke. You know, there's so many facts, and they go in so many different directions. I don't have the foggiest idea, really, what our objective is. What are we after? I want to try to focus this inquiry.
I'm trying to focus on the president. What did the president know, and when did he know it? Can you tell us whether or not you can shed any further light on whether the president knew of the break-in of the Watergate complex on June 17th?
You mean, did he have prior knowledge of it?
Yes.
I cannot testify of any first-hand knowledge of that.
John W. Dean III went before the Senate Watergate Committee today and, as expected, gave the committee names, dates, and places involved in the Watergate affair and its cover-up. Included among those names of the names of those having knowledge of the cover-up was Dean's former boss, the President of the United States. We have a full report from ABC's Sam Donaldson.
John Dean came with his wife and lawyers, carrying with him an exhaustively detailed, if sometimes ungrammatical, 245-page written statement. But it was not the grammar that shocked the Irvin Committee. It was the charge that the President knowingly participated in the Watergate cover-up. A charge Dean put on the record in an almost offhand way at the outset.
It is my honest belief that while the president was involved, that he did not realize or appreciate at any time the implications of his involvement. And I think that when the facts come out, I hope the president is forgiven.
Dean claimed he didn't know anything about the Watergate break-in until the burglars were caught. He said it came as a complete surprise to him when the president told the nation in late August that Dean's investigation had cleared White House personnel. In fact, said Dean, what he'd been doing during that period was not investigating Watergate, but on Ehrlichman and Haldeman's instructions, covering it up. Then, reading in a dry, toneless style, Dean leveled his first direct charge implicating the president.
On September 15th, the Justice Department announced the handing down of 7 indictments by the federal grand jury investigating the Watergate. Late that afternoon, I received a call requesting me to come to the president's Oval Office. When I arrived at the Oval Office, I found Mr. Haldeman, the president, and the president. The president asked me to sit down. Both men appeared to be in very good spirits, and my reception was warm and cordial. The president then told me that Bob, referring to Mr. Haldeman, had kept him posted on my handling of the Watergate case. The president told me I had done a good job, and he appreciated how difficult a task it had been, and the president was pleased that the case had stopped with Liddy. I responded that I could not take credit because others had done much more difficult things than I had done. As the president discussed the present status of the situation, I told him that all I'd been able to do was to contain the case and assist in keeping it out of the White House. I also told him that there was a long way to go before this matter would end, and that I certainly could make no assurances that the day would not come when this matter would not start to unravel. The conversation then moved to the press coverage of the Watergate incident and how the press was really trying to make this into a major campaign issue. At one point in the conversation, I recall the president telling me to keep a good list of the press people giving us trouble because we'll make life difficult for them after the election.
Dean claimed that White House efforts were successful in preventing a House committee investigation before the election and in postponing the various civil suits. Dean said he didn't see the president directly again until February of this year. Then a series of meetings took place with the president on Watergate, according to Dean, including one on March 13th, a portion of which Dean recalled this way.
I told the president about the fact that there were money demands being made by the seven convicted defendants, and that the sentencing of these individuals was not far off. It was during this conversation that Haldeman came into the office. After this brief interruption by Haldeman's coming in, but while he was still there, I told the president about the fact that there was no money to pay these individuals to meet their demands. He asked me how much it would cost. I told him I could only make an estimate that it might be as high as $1 million or more. He told me that that was no problem. He also looked over at Haldeman and repeated the same statement. He then asked me who was demanding this money, and I told him it was principally coming from Hunt through his attorney. The president then referred to the fact that Hunt had been promised executive clemency. He said that he had discussed this matter with Ehrlichman, and contrary to instructions that Ehrlichman had given Colson not to talk to the president about it, that Colson had also discussed it with him later.
Dean says that by March 21st, he was convinced the cover-up was falling apart, and he said he met with the president on that day to tell him so and urge that everyone come clean.
I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately because it was growing more deadly every day. I concluded by saying that this is going to take continued perjury and continued support of these individuals to perpetuate the cover-up, and that I did not believe it was possible to so continue it. Rather, I thought it was time for surgery of the cancer itself, and that all of those involved must stand up and account for themselves, and that the president himself get out in front of this matter. I told the president that I did not believe that all seven defendants would maintain their silence forever. In fact, I thought that one or more would very likely break rank. After I finished, I realized I had not really made the president understand because he asked me a few questions, and he discussed that it would be an excellent idea if I gave some sort of briefing to the cabinet, and that he was very impressed with my knowledge of the circumstances but not seem particularly concerned with their implications.
Dean said that after the March 21st meeting with the president, it seemed to him the White House now considered him the problem. Dean got a lawyer and went to see the federal prosecutors. Then on the evening of April 15th, Dean said he went to see the president.
The president almost from the outset began asking me a number of leading questions, which was somewhat unlike his normal conversational relationships I'd had with him, which made me think that the conversation was being taped and a record was being made to protect himself. Although I became aware of this because of the nature of the conversation, I decided I did not know it for a fact and that I had to believe that the president would not tape such a conversation. Toward the end of the conversation, the president recalled the fact that at one point we had discussed the difficulty in raising money, and that he said that $1 million was nothing to raise to pay to maintain the silence for the defendants. He said that he had, of course, only been joking when he made that comment. As I was on my way out of the office after exchanging parting pleasantries, I told the president that I hoped that my going to the prosecutors and telling the truth would not result in impeachment of the president. He jokingly said, "I certainly hope so also." And he said that it would be handled properly.
Now it is on the public record, John Dean's damning, if largely unsubstantiated, testimony against the president. Tomorrow, the Irvin Committee begins cross-examination of Dean, and it is sure to be fierce, for nothing less than Richard Nixon's presidency may ride on whether the public believes John Dean or not.
The fact that I was involved in obstruction of justice, the fact that I assisted another in perjured testimony, the fact that I made personal use of funds that were in my custody. It's far easier to talk about these things myself than to talk about what others did. The president told me I had done a good job, and he appreciated how difficult a task it had been, and the president was pleased that the case had stopped with Liddy. I responded that I could not take credit because others had done much more difficult things than I had done. As the president discussed the present status of the situation, I told him that all I've been able to do was to contain the case and assist in keeping it out of the White House. I also told him that there was a long way to go before this matter would end, and that I certainly could make no assurances that the day would not come when this matter would not start to unravel. What I had hoped to do in this conversation was to have the president tell me we had to end the matter now. Accordingly, I gave considerable thought to how I would present this situation to the president and try to make as dramatic a presentation as I could to tell him how serious I thought the situation was that the cover-up continue. I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and that if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately, because it was growing more deadly every day.
The central question at this point is simply put, what did the president know, and when did he know it?
During 7 days in the hospital, the president licked viral pneumonia and came out fighting against the barrage of Watergate problems. To White House employees welcoming him back, Mr. Nixon made his intentions clear.
Another bit of advice, too, that I am not going to take. Oh, it really isn't advice. I was rather amused by some very well-intentioned people who thought that perhaps the burdens of the office and, you know, some of the rather rough assaults that any man in this office gets from time to time brings on an illness. And that after going through such an illness that I might get so tired that I would consider either slowing down or even some suggested resigning. Well, now, just so we set that to rest, I want to use a phrase that my Ohio father used to use. Any suggestion that this president's ever going to slow down while he's president, or is ever going to leave this office until he continues to do the job and finishes the job he was elected to do, anyone who suggests that, that's just plain poppycock. We're going to stay on this job till we get the job done. And what we were elected to do, we are going to do. And let others wallow in Watergate, we're going to do our job.
Thank you.